Extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle. It's August 12th. It's a Monday. Leagues Cup round of 16 about to kick off on MLS Season Pass on Apple TV. Big show today because deadline day is 2 days away in Major League Soccer. We're going to go through all the rumors, all the signings that got done since we were last with you, and all the holes that still need to be filled. Looking at you, Red Bulls. Plus, we're going to rank the League's Cup Final 16 based on our own, I don't know, it's not math. It's just gut feeling of win probability, and it's a big day, Doyle. What do you think today is? It's almost like a holiday of sorts at Extra Time.
It is the producer derby.
Ah, you knew!
It is the biggest of days, Andrew Wiebe. As everybody knows, longtime listeners of this program know that Anders win cut bleeds rave green. He's Sounders till he dies. Producer Maria is an even bigger Unam Pumas fan. They did not know each other 2 years ago during the CONCACAF Champions League final, but they are close compatriots in the office, in the studio, producing this show and everything else under the sun in MLS. They are invaluable. And tonight they are mortal enemies because it is Seattle Sounders hosting Unam Pumas in the round of 16 of the League's Cup. Two people enter, one person leaves. That's how it goes.
At 10:30 p.m. Eastern time. Season pass. You know how to get at this one. The last time I saw both of them, and boy, I see Anders and Maria all the time, like more than my family almost. And I'm not saying that as a negative thing. The last time I saw them, Doyle, Anders was in, I want to say, the Clint Dempsey first-year Sounders kit plus Sounders hat. I want to say Maria was in a Pumas jacket, and I want to say that there were further layers underneath that also had Pumas. And I think she was carrying around a flag after the Vancouver Whitecaps loss.
And she also has a tendency to sort of stroll or skip through the hallways singing Pumas songs at the top of her very small lungs.
Go, yeah.
Which I've never seen Anders do. I've never seen Anders scream fight and win in the studio. So I think we know who the bigger fan is of these two people.
Yeah, we will see if that translates to results tonight as we record here today. But one game, round of 16 game on Monday, and then seven on Tuesday. And then we'll go on to the quarterfinals, semis, and finals on August 25th. Big show here. Well, let's start with the breaking news. It just came through my inbox. And as soon as it did, we all just kind of looked at each other in the pre-show meeting and said, can you believe it? George Heights is departing the Chicago Fire. Matt Doyle, I didn't think this would happen based on my reading of the press release. He will not be with Lugano. Heights saying for personal reasons, he needs to go back to Switzerland. I always assumed based on the work that he had done for owner Joe Mansueto, who of course owns the Fire, but also Lugano. And it seems like they're building out something a little bit bigger, like almost like a little network of clubs. I always thought that Heights would just go back and lead this network or go back and be in charge of Lugano. But it seems like this is a clean break. And the timing seems interesting. The season's not over here, Doyle, and the transfer window is not over either. The Fire haven't made any moves. Understandable if Heights leaving was in the cards this whole time. What's your initial reaction, and then what's your read on what it means for the Fire short, medium, and long term?
So I'm going to correct something that because there's starting to be info coming out from a lot of the folks who cover the Fire. Alex Calabrese does a really good job. Orange Schwartz out there has been forever. The guys that, I'm blanking on the name of the block. But anyway, there's a lot of good coverage of the Fire. So go find them on
Hot Town, Hot Time in Old Town.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
So the Fire will commence, quote, a global search for the next sporting director. Heights will remain on Lugano's board of directors.
Aha. Yes. So right. my feeling was
incorrect. But that doesn't mean that he will have decision-making power. From a business perspective, Heights has done very well selling players from the Fire to Europe. I think it's unquestionable that he catalyzed academy growth and the path into the first team for these kids who have been really good players. I have a 22 under 22 article coming out today. It might be out already on MLSsoccer.com by the time you're listening to this. And like, Brian Gutierrez and Chris Brady are way up that list, and there's another crop coming behind them. And I think York Heights deserves some credit for that. But yeah, definitely time for him to go. Surprised he's actually staying on through the end of the season. And that leads me to believe that there's going to be some continuity in the front office, which is maybe not what Fire fans want to hear. And to that end, Alex Calabrese is reporting Sebastian Pelser, who is the technical director under Heights, remains under contract and as of now will not depart. So maybe this is a question of they like what Heights has done on a business level and they want to keep him in the organization, but they want to give Pelser a chance to sort of make the decisions at a chief soccer officer level. If that's the case, I wouldn't be overly thrilled if I was a Chicago Fire fan. All of this is happening with in conjunction of what you said, Andrew, which is they haven't made a single move really this transfer window. If they have made a move, I've missed it. And that would tell you the size of the move that they've made. It'd be very, very small. And this for a team that has been, over the past 4 or 5 years under Joe Mansueto, the owner, has been one of the highest spending and most aggressive in the league. The fact that they haven't made any move like that gives me the impression that they want to have as sort of clean a book as possible heading into 2025 under presumably new leadership. Whether that new leadership is Pelser or whether it's someone who is going to come from that global search that they referenced, we don't know just yet, but it's very few moving parts right now in order to maybe facilitate a winter that becomes an entire teardown and rebuild, which in my opinion is kind of what they need.
There's also the element here of on the coaching side, right? I mean, and I don't want to like hang Frey Klopas out to dry. He's an incredible servant of the Chicago Fire, has done everything he can in that job. But I don't think Frank Klopas looks at this and says, I'm the long-term coach of the Chicago Fire. Unless I'm crazy.
I mean, it's a results-oriented business and the results have not been good. And that's not all Frank Klopas's fault, but he hasn't solved any of the issues that the roster has presented.
I want to ask here, I mean, I agree with all those things. Plus, it's his second stint. Plus, they pulled him out of, I mean, he'll just go, to me, you just bring him back into a role within the club if the managerial side ends. It's not like Frank Klopas and the Fire end. It's just that this was not the role for the long term. Now, Greg Berhalter's floating around. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were reading tea leaves here, as far as these dominoes that are falling and the things that are changing with the Fire, does that leave a gap for Greg to slot in there somewhere?
I think so, but I also don't. I think Greg Berhalter at this point, if he takes an MLS job, he would want to have something close to complete control. You know, he would want the Peter Vermees or what Bruce Arena had in New England before it fell apart.
Do you think so?
I do. I do. Whether he has the juice to get that, I don't know. I do know his family is still in Chicago. His daughter's on a club team out there. She plays on the club team, and they haven't moved that I'm aware of. It seems like I think Greg Berhalter would be a really good – he already has been a really good coach in MLS. I think if you gave him the type of budget that that York Heights got, I think Greg Berhalter would build a contender in MLS, a team that would year in, year out, be, you know, top four in the Eastern Conference and always a threat to win something. Now, does he need to have the head coach and chief soccer officer titles? I don't know.
That's the part I'm not so convinced about, because the model isn't modern anymore, right? Like the names you're listing, the projects we're talking about, the era that was prevalent in, I mean, that seems to me to be mostly over. Like the most successful clubs in the league do not operate that way.
I think you're correct.
So I don't know why Greg would want that necessarily. I think maybe it insulates him and puts him in a better position for success if he has a competent, successful, you know, running on all cylinders, or at least somewhere close to it, front office that he can augment and influence and say, these are the players I want, help me go get them. I don't know why you would, I'm not sure why you would want that full job in this era of MLS. It feels to me like it sets you up to be the fall guy on all fronts.
I think so, but I don't think coaches at that level think about the downside. I think all of these guys are wired in a way where it's like, if I have my people in place and the budget that I want, then we're going to succeed. And I don't need to worry about having a fall guy. I don't need to worry about someone taking the blame, because it's not going to be blame. It's going to be success. I think that's like every high level coach is wired like that to some degree. And I suspect Berhalter is as well. That said, I think a better setup, I agree with you, a better setup would be like, he's the head coach, and you know, who's a close assistant. I don't know. Who's one of his close assistants from the national team?
BJ's in Nashville. I guess Lucci doesn't have a job.
There you go. Lucci
currently. Nico doesn't either. Yeah.
Yeah. Lucci or Nico get to be the titular general manager, something like that.
I'm not even sure that works anymore. I mean, Minnesota United's a good example of that with Inchi and, why can't I remember?
Boy, we're struggling today. This is a Monday show, man.
I know it is. You get the point. I just think whether it's Atlanta or the Chicago or whatever it is, I'm not completely convinced that Greg Berhalter's like, I need it all. So we'll see with the fire, because we don't exactly know.
We don't even know that Greg Berhalter is going to be in the frame here in terms of considering him for GM or coach or both or whatever. But this is just rank speculation. But I think overall, this has to feel like a good day for Chicago Fire fans.
Yep. We'll see what happens with the fire. Right now, as you said, rank speculation is a good way to put that. We are just
trade, my friend.
Exactly. We're just walking through the dominoes, you know, internally, just trying to figure out where we think this might go. We do know where the round of 32 went, so let's hit that real quick for Leagues Cup before we move into the transfer zone. What's the best thing you saw round of 32, Doyle?
The San Jose Earthquakes.
Say it with your chest.
5-0 over Necaxa, who had been playing decent.
Got
out of the group stage, and the Quakes just buried him. You know, Jeremy Abobasi had a couple goals, which, of course, we love to see. But the entire attack was just relentless and dynamic. And I've been writing all year long that I think the Quakes are so much better than their current record. I'm not sure that they're, you know, a playoff caliber team, but they're not like 14 points through two-thirds of the season team. Like they're just better than that. And they haven't played like it at all. And they came out in the first 35 minutes. They scored four goals. Your guy Amal Pellegrino had a couple assists. The way Jackson Yule kind of strode out of central midfield and scored the first goal, like where has that been? So it just sort of all clicked into place for at least one night. I guess the second night this year, because they did beat LAFC 3-0 earlier this season. But it was awesome. And the biggest, I wrote this a couple of weeks ago. The best outcome for the Quakes for the rest of this season is that Abobasi breaks whatever curse has been placed on him and starts looking like the guy he was 2 years ago when he scored 17 goals in the regular season. And he's now got, what, 4 goals in 3 games in League's Cup? And they're like, he scored a banger in this one, but he also scored like a pretty pure striker's goal. And he found a ton of chances against Chivas, and he was relentless off the ball. And like, that is a massive win for the Quakes right now, and hopefully down the stretch, because I still think Jeremy Obobese can be a top 10 center forward in this league. And now with Lopez and you know, Espinoza still there, and Pellegrino's dealing a little bit, like, this is a fun team to watch. They've just been missing that guy who puts the ball in the back of the net. So congratulations to the Quakes. I really enjoyed, for that suffering fan base, I really enjoyed watching them put together a performance like that.
The Hernan Lopez back heel assist is just absolutely delicious.
Do you think it made Ryan Reynolds cry?
I you know what? I was going to say I hope so, and I still feel that deep inside of me. But whatever it takes, man. Whatever it takes. The Quakes have been the ones shedding the tears. So if they get to force somebody else to break down, all good. Nacox is out. San Jose on. I love that one. You know, look, if we're talking to Bobasi and strikers coming good and shaking off whatever it is that's been plaguing them or cursing them or fill in the blank, Ty Baribo, man, he couldn't even get a sniff with the Philadelphia Union, Doyle. Bags a brace. He's got 7 goals in his last 6 games, I think. I think it's 9 goals since he entered the lineup for the Philadelphia Union. And they look like themselves again. And it's not just Baribo. It's more than that. It's I think Sam Adeniran has been a really good addition. And it finally feels like the page has turned.
Yeah.
You know, the Julian Carranza page of like, will they keep him? Will they not? What are they going to do without him? Can they re-sign him? Why does he want to leave? Will they reinvest? All these things. Do they have the quality? And it turned out they had a guy who was absolutely starving on the bench. And Ty Baribo's absolutely hit a heater. I'd also throw out there the Crew debuts. I mean, first of all, they absolutely pummeled Sporting Kansas City. So much so to the point that Johnny Russell afterwards was like, it is sobering, and I'm paraphrasing here, it is sobering to see the gap in quality between them and us. Because this is now, I think, in the last, what, month or so, month and a half, that Columbus has absolutely put Kansas City to the sword. Like, just outclassed them in every single way. DeJuan Jones scores a goal in the way that you would expect the left wing back in this system to score a goal. They get a goal from Dylan Chambost. Andres Herrera has not even played for this team, but they have Mo Farsi anyway. It just feels like from strength to strength, depth point to depth point, the Crew are locked, loaded, and poised to do something special either in League's Cup or the rest of the regular season or in, you know, the playoffs or in, you know, CCC if they qualify next year, or fill in the blank for as long as they have Wilfred Nancy. And congrats. Have to go to Issa Tall because he's cooking.
Do they win a trophy this year?
I think the odds that they don't is higher than they do, right? Like, just based on a numbers game.
So they got 4. They got 4 they're still playing for, because it's League's Cup, Campeones Cup, okay, Shield.
Yeah. Mark me down. Yeah. If we're counting Campeones Cup here, which we should. Mark me down. Yeah, well, they're getting a trophy.
All right.
All right. Most disappointing exit round of 32. Who got drop-kicked and you're like, that's a bummer?
DC United, because I actually thought that they were playing better in the group stage than they had been. Troy Lesane has gone from that 3-5-2 that was, I think, a lot of fun at times this year, but asks them to put an extra center back on the field, and they don't really have many center backs, to a sort of a 4-1-3-2 with Matthias Klick kind of playing as a sort of a number 10, but sort of a number 8, and allowing the shuttlers to get forward a little bit more, almost like wingers rather than shuttlers. It reminded me of sort of the Y midfield that Bruce Arena played with that great 2014 Galaxy team. And Mattia Kamboni was starting at center back, and he's still just 17 years old, which is insanely young for a starting center back. But this kid is, I think, pretty clearly the highest upside center back in the U.S. youth national team pool, even though he wasn't part of that U-20 team that did so well in CONCACAF championship. And they were taking it to Mazatlan. I thought they were the better team than Mazatlan in the first 20-25 minutes. And then Jared Stroud gets just a brainless, absolutely unnecessary red card. It was like it was like they could have put together a performance. I'm not saying they would have scored five, but they could have put together a performance that was galvanizing in the same way that San Jose's win over Necaxa was galvanizing. But instead, the guy who's been their second best player this year loses his mind, gets sent off needlessly, takes the air completely out of the game, and 2-1 loss. Goodbye, DC United.
It felt like deja vu for any number of MLS and CCL or CCC or whatever iteration fill in the blank over the years, where you see promise early from an MLS team and you think maybe this is the time, only for that big sort of teeter-totter moment to be, one, a bad decision-making process or unlucky or whatever. It just felt like, oh yeah, I've seen this show before. I've seen this.
Yep.
I felt the same way with the Dynamo or Orlando City. Those are my disappointing exits.
The Dynamo not finishing off one of the 18 breakaways they had.
Oh my God. Sebas, if we're not going to make the right decision, just shoot it hard at the goal. The worst case scenario is to not get a shot off. The worst case. And then the goal that was called back that was narrowly offside. I mean, again, like, it just feels like deja vu. All these little moments, or big ones, that just for whatever reason don't quite fall. And for Orlando City, who I thought played better than Cruz Azul, no doubt about it.
Well, they were much better.
And it's just a theme for Orlando City in the same way, whether it was that Tigre series or fill-in-the-blank opportunities. Almost. And it doesn't feel better for Martina Anselmi, the manager of Cruz Azul, to come out afterwards and be like, hey, Orlando City is one of the best teams I've coached against with this club. Like, that's almost like the stab in the side, right? Because you didn't win.
Right.
You didn't win. Anyway.
I'm gonna derail our outline for the show a little bit. And let's just talk about Houston. And I think a little bit about Orlando, because these are two teams that we've been saying all year long, if you do this, then you're a better team and you have a chance to win something. And for Orlando, it was if you play Martino, if either you get a number 10 or you play Martino Hayda as a number 10, because he is a pure chance creator, and that frees up the other guys to, you know, Facu Torres to be Facu Torres and the forwards to not have to drop in. They can be forwards. Then they're back to being in a borderline elite team in the East again. And for Houston, it was, if you go out and you get a starting number 9 and a goal dangerous 1v1 merchant of a left winger, then they're as good as anybody. Do we feel that way now? Have they done the right things? Like, what's our confidence level in both these teams for the stretch run?
For sure, playoff teams. Houston are sitting. Let's see. I just resorted the table. Yeah, Houston are on the line. Basically, they're just a hair above. Wait, what am I looking at? Okay, we're in sixth. Sorry, I've been ordering it by goals scored and goals allowed just to remind myself where Houston stand. And I mean, Houston's defense is not the issue, it's obviously the attack. I loved what Ben Olsen was saying about Ponce this week, even in the wake of that loss, which is that he's everything that we could have asked for. I think they're still waiting for him to, you know, be as efficient as they hope he will be in front of goal. I know he got his first one, but he had a couple chances in that match. But you can just see off the ball that he's going to bring a level of activity and intelligence they just haven't had it. Like, they haven't had a true center forward, and even when Sebas came back, he's not at that level. So I think Houston are there, and I don't discount home field advantage the rest of the way. It seems like from about mid-July through the later stages of summer, Houston is not the place you want to be, and unfortunately for the Dynamo, they haven't really capitalized on that yet. And I thought it was interesting what Oscar Pareja said about Martino Hayda, because I asked him about this on Countdown the other day before their match. And he said that Ojeda had to basically earn the trust of the coaching staff as well. What do you think that means?
It usually that means defense, right? It's like professionalism in terms of how you carry yourself in practice and maybe even off the field as well. Not that I've heard anything negative about Ojeda in that regard, but then what you do on the field. Do you suffer for your team in terms of playing against the ball in a way that makes the coaching staff trust you? The greatest number 10s in league history are what they are because of the magic that they bring. but also all of them, even Marco Echeverri, back 25 years now, 30 years, was willing to work against the ball in the biggest moments, in the biggest games. And when Oscar Pereja says that about Ojeda, I think that's exactly what he means. And I think we've seen that from Ojeda. I thought we saw it before the middle of this season, but we certainly saw it throughout this. Like, part of the reason I think that Orlando were so difficult to play against from Cruz Azul's perspective is that Ojeda was sitting on the defensive midfielder, forcing them to find other ways of distributing the ball. So I don't know. I like what I've seen from Orlando. Disappointing exit. I'm with you in that regard. It's cold comfort to hear the other coach say, oh yeah, this is one of the best teams I've played all year. That's great. We're going home. But I think something to look forward to down the stretch and into the playoffs, where they will definitely be. Orlando City's a playoff team.
I think the same goes for both of them. I also just think back to, like, it took, for instance, even Mauro Diaz, though he was young, a while to work his way into, you know, the full-time good graces of Oscar Pereja.
It's true.
So I don't know. We'll see. It seems like Ojeda being in the lineup is a big boon for them. Okay, let's keep this thing rolling. It's probably time to hit some transfers around these parts, because it has been absolutely, absolutely busy. We'll get to the round of 16 and all those matchups here in just a little bit. This is brought to you mostly by Tommy Scoops. Remember, the close of the transfer window is August 14th. It is August 12th today as we're recording this. Free agents will still be able to sign an MLS through the roster freeze deadline. That's on September 13th. So, for instance, though, it looks like it 100% will get done. Marco Reus could conceivably sign until September 13th, and you could say that about any other player who's out of contract. So this is the deadline for interleague transfers. There is still an availability to sign players through September 13th. Just to give you an idea of what's happened already, I'm just going to run through some big signings here, Doyle, just to remind ourselves, because I think we get spoiled in this age of MLS with the amount of money that's flying around, with the profiles that are coming in. And let's make sure we don't forget Alexi Marinchuk, already to Atlanta from Atalanta. That one's done. Osman Bukhari, seems like it was done a long time ago, because it was in the end of May, basically. But he's starting to find his feet for Austin. Dessler is the same thing for Austin. Tim Ream signed for Charlotte. Jozy Awaziam signed for Cincinnati, and they might have more coming. We'll talk about that, because Aaron Bupenza is not out of contract, is one way of putting it. He is no longer on the books for Cincy. In Columbus, we talked about the foursome: Chambos, Jones, AZ, and Herrera. Ponce and Anali for Houston. Giroux, Lewis O'Brien for LAFC. David Martinez for Miami. Kelvin Yeboah, Jefferson Diaz, Mateus Kemet for Minnesota. Maybe one more coming, a big-time number 10 out of Argentina we'll talk about in a second. Luca Langoni, who we haven't talked about, but cost the Revs, what, $7 million from Boca Juniors? Diego Goncalves, the new DP for Real Salt Lake, signed from Copenhagen. He was a Portuguese guy who had started his career at Benfica, I believe.
I have to interrupt you. You will get an angry voice memo from Eric Krakauer.
Help me.
Goncalves. The Portuguese C with that little, you know, dingleberry, that's an S.
All right. That will help me remember. I will never forget that based on your description. Marcel Hartl and Toy Shirt in St. Louis and many more. So let's jump into it here. Let's start with Real Salt Lake. Busy, busy, busy for the last four transfer windows. I want to say they've spent like almost $25 million over the course of those windows, bringing in a ton of new players. Andres Gomez was one of those players, and it seems like Andres Gomez is on his way out. It's not official, but we're talking about it as if it is official, because Tom Boger to San Stad Rennes has agreed a fee with RSL. That's in the ballpark of $11 million plus add-ons, which could be a couple million, and then a sell-on, says Fabrizio Romano, of 15%. They wanted to hold on to the 21-year-old Colombian for as long as they could. It seemed like they were going to try through the end of the season. But Doyle, this feels like a no-brainer number, and they've gone and reinforced. You know, obviously Lachlan Brook already in, Benji Michel in, and then there's a Polish guy that they're going to bring in. It seems like Dominic Marzuk. This feels to me like RSL separating themselves in a lot of ways from like that middle of the pack team. That, oh, we're a smaller market team, we can't spend as much, and really embracing the like modern era of MLS where you have to buy. But you're also going to have to sell for most clubs to make that sustainable.
Yeah, well, that was the thing, right? Under the previous ownership, they were never willing to – they were developing players, but they were never willing to sell them. And I think that frustrated, the front office before this one. And what we've seen is that this new ownership is, it really has sort of embraced the part that they play in the global transfer market. We saw it with Fidel Barajas, and now we've seen it with Andres Gomez. And that's at least $15 million between those two guys, probably more, which they have, you know, they preemptively invested that in the squad with purchases like Palacio and Chicho Arango. You know, Brian Ojeda was about $3.5-4 million. Like they have
Brian Vera is another name to throw in there.
There you go. So like they have spent money,
Petranis,
and now they have on the other side of it gone out and you know developed and sold, and they want to have that reputation, not just for the teams in Europe that want to go shopping, but for the players in South America, so they can do it with the next Andres Gomez. It's disappointing that they're not able to hold him through the end of the season, because he's a special player. And I, a four-headed attack of Chicho up top with Gonzalez as the number 10 and you know Gomez on one side and Diego Luna on the other, that's as good as almost anything that we see in MLS. It's a championship-winning attack. So the pressure will be on Pablo Mastroianni to make sure that either the Polish kid or Lachlan Brook, the Australian kid that they signed, is able to step into that role. But that's part of the game, man. Part of being one of the best teams in MLS, which is the goal, is to be able to fill those gaps on the fly with few issues. It's a test, but it's a fun one to watch them try to handle.
It just feels like all of the pieces of the puzzle for RSL have real sinew between them. You know, whether it be from down from the academy into, you know, into the MLS Next Pro side, MLS to the first team side, and then of course Kurt Schmidt at the top of one side and Pablo Mastroianni at the top of the technical staff, and then all the assistants that they brought in underneath. It just feels like everything is compatible and working together. Now, the question, as you said, is can they make that championship quality this year? And Schmidt told our boy Tom Boger to give me sport that you have to strike while the iron's hot. And that goes both ways, obviously, in terms of buying and in terms of selling. On the buying side, they got it done, man. There's a lot of teams out there and fans out there that have real transfer envy about empty DP spots and things that their club said they would do that they haven't been able to do. Gonsalves, they got done. And he seems like he has won a really good profile, 27 years old, speaks English, has bounced around a few leagues, so should be able to adapt quickly. And the fee just north of $3 million for a guy that had 11 goals and 6 assists and about 2,500 minutes last season. Like that's a good, that's like, it was like a high percentage swing.
He was an excellent player in the league that produced Hani Mukhtar. You know, like you go, it's a copycat league, it's a copycat business. And if you see Danish clubs putting really good, or in Mukhtar's case, MVP caliber attacking talent into MLS, then you go shopping in the Danish league. And Gonsalves, you know, his profile is really good. He has bounced around. He has played multiple positions. He has finally settled in as a number 10, who is the kind of hardworking, doesn't need a ton of the ball to control the game number 10 that fits next to Luna. I think this actually puts more of the game at Luna's feet. On the face of it, I like this move a lot. And he's the right age, 27 years old. He could be there the next 6-7 years.
I think I would compare it, you know, not in profile, but you know, if Hani Mukhtar is our original reference point, I think Evander is the most recent reference point.
Yeah, that's a good one.
For a guy like this coming out of Denmark, I am not in any way saying that he's going to be Evander. The price tag on Evander was much higher. I think there are things that Evander can do that very few can. But we have to get to know Gonsalves here a little bit. But this seems like a really good signing at a good number. And this is where MLS should be shopping in a lot of ways. Teams like RSL, teams like, you know, Columbus or Kansas City, et cetera, where you're saying, okay, well, we've got $3-4 million. Where can we go? What kind of players can we get? What kind of markets need this cash infusion? Well, right now in Europe, these are the kind of markets. All right, let's see. Charlotte, a number 10 incoming. Doyle, speaking of teams that are checking the box, it's not official, but Fabromano is saying The agreement for Calvin Stengs from Feyenoord is done to come to Charlotte. The $8 million fee and a four-year deal agreed. It sounds like they've just got some, you know, all crossing the T's, dotting the I's, et cetera, to get done. This feels huge. This feels like the sort of move that we were begging the club to make, and maybe one at an age profile that I wasn't expecting them to do it at.
He's 25 years old. He is a fringe Dutch international. Eight appearances. He has three goals in those appearances for the Dutch. For Feyenoord last year, which, you know, if you know anything about European soccer, you probably know that Feyenoord are one of the big three in the Eredivisie. 44 appearances across all competitions, 8 goals, 18 assists. He is a through ball artist. He's a big dude. He's like 6'2", 6'3". But he, you know, and you don't see a lot of those guys who play as classic number 10s. He plays as a classic number 10. Like, he looks more South American than Dutch in how he plays the game. I cannot, it feels like a groundbreaking move. Feyenoord sells their players to Bundesliga teams, to Serie A teams, to La Liga or Premier League teams. An MLS team coming in and buying the starting number 10 from Feyenoord, who's not 35 years old, he's 25 years old. It is one of the groundbreaking moves in MLS history if this gets done. He's also the exact type of number 10 that I think Charlotte need, because he is such a through ball artist and because Dean Smith wants those wingers to always get out into the open field and attack. Like, when Stengs is on the ball, you are one pass away every time, no matter if he's, you know, 30 yards from goal or he's 85 yards from goal, you are one pass away. It looks perfect. The only concern is, like, he's had a knee issue in the past, so maybe that lowered, like, he's not much of a defensive presence. Like, maybe that scared away, you know, some of the big continental teams. And that could be it, right? Because Charlotte are probably like, we can pay you $4.5 million. And nobody else is, like, pretty much only the top teams in Europe or, like, Premier League clubs play that, pay that much. So maybe that's what this comes down to. And if that's the case, that is fine. That is a great business to be in, because that, like, if this guy is as good for Charlotte as he has been for Feyenoord, Charlotte will be everybody's dark horse MLS Cup pick. And if they keep him happy, then that's the focal point of their team, sorted out until 2030. Like, it could be just a complete groundbreaking acquisition if this goes through and he's the player that he was last year.
I completely agree. I'm just going to be the yeah, but guy just for a second. And just in terms of the knee stuff, and, you know, look, there's a turf field in Charlotte. We don't got to, you know, tiptoe around that fact. The other thing is he did just have one big season for Feyenoord. And that came on the heels of sort of 2 years not playing a ton for Nice and then on loan at Antwerp. He had good years with AZ before that, but he's not exactly been what you would call an innings eater in terms of minutes in his career. And if you come to Charlotte as the number 10 with the $8 million price tag, the four-year deal, the profile, all that stuff, the expectation is that you're going to be on the field. And that's probably the sell for guys like this too, of like, come be the man. Come make a ton of money and come be the man. We've got a world-class, you know, medical setup here for you. And we've got an environment where we think that you can thrive. And I could see how that would be incredibly attractive to a guy like Calvin Stengs.
Let me just push back a little bit.
Do it.
So I'm looking at his numbers, 22-23 season across all competitions. And he started that year with Nice in Ligue 1. And then he went to Royal Antwerp. He played almost 3,000 minutes.
Okay.
Across all competitions. Didn't put up big numbers, which is fine. Sometimes it doesn't work. The year before that, 21-22, he played a little over 1,000 minutes. But then 2021 in the Eredivisie with AZ Alkmaar.
That was his big breakout. Yep.
So almost 3,000 minutes in three of the last four seasons. Hopefully that knee is 100%. Hopefully they get this done. If he is the player that, I'll say it again, if he's a player for Charlotte that he was for Feyenoord, this will go down as a franchise club-changing move in the way that getting Nico Ladero was for Seattle 8.5 years ago.
Where do you think Charlotte sits in sort of the MLS hierarchy transfer-wise? Because it feels to me like they are they're one of the teams who might not be in the like LA teams, Atlanta zone, that are very clearly willing to play a little bit of bully ball with the pocketbook.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like they're in that Chicago Fire, Toronto FC up until a couple of years ago.
I think you'd have to throw FC Cincinnati into that as well.
Cincinnati has spent, yes, I guess so. I think you're right. Yeah. And within that sort of the scope of like what those teams have done, this feels like, unless I'm missing something obvious here, this feels like the most impressive single move to get. Again, he's a 25-year-old fringe Dutch international who was a starter for a Champions League team and produced goals and assists as a number 10 across 3,000 minutes last year. That's really good. That's the kind of move that you dream of. You hope against hope that your team makes if you're a fan.
It feels to me like it's a little bit out of the same general zone as Abada in terms of an age profile that's younger. I mean, Abada is 22, so it's a little bit different, but who had performed at, you know, a level below, let's say, the very top level in Europe and had occupied a big place, and then they're willing to go spend a sizable transfer fee to rest him away.
I think so, though. The reported transfer fee for Stengs is about half what they paid for Abada, which is incredible to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. All right. Speaking of fees.
I just want to say we've had fun with Zoran Crneta in the past because he has given some incredibly memeable quotes. But he seems like a guy who has learned from his mistakes on the job, learned about, you know, valuing guys from within the academy and from the super draft, and learned where to shop and who to shop for. And man, I hope this one works out because Stengs is a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, from the space and time after official recording, we're back with a little drop in. We've never done this before, but I just saw a tweet from Fabrizio Romano. Charlotte now in London to start talks for an ambitious move to bring Miguel Almirón back to MLS. Initial approach made with Newcastle, not an easy deal, but Charlotte will be trying, says Fabrizio Romano. Those sounds of shrieking and tears and pounding against walls are the Atlanta United fans.
Yeah, pray for Rob Usery. I love that an MLS team wants to bring Miggy back to MLS. He's one of the his tenure here was short, but he left such a huge impression with those great Atlanta teams. He's still, as he showed last year with Newcastle, he's still an excellent player. He's 30, so he's not one that you're buying and you're thinking we're going to build everything around him. But that's what's so great about Miguel Almirón, is that he has the ability to toggle between first option, second option in terms of being a playmaker. And if they're going to get the Stengs deal done, and Fabrizio also reported in the time between us talking about Charlotte and the recording finishing, Fabrizio reported that the Stengs deal is like signed or done and it'll be official in the next 24 hours. So if the Stengs deal is done, he's your number 10, then Almirón arrives and becomes one of your two wingers, presumably with Liel Abada as the other. Here's the issue. Karol Swiderski is still there. That's four DPs. So that tells me that there's a move coming. If Almirón gets done, that there's a move coming, most likely that move would be Swiderski landing, I think, probably back in Europe.
Miguel Almirón to Charlotte. I mean, come on. This is. And then you're talking about Vargas basically as an impact player off the bench, and he's been pretty productive. Ajiman in that same sort of space.
I mean, this makes Ajiman the starting number nine for the rest of the season, which you gotta love, Weeby.
If this happens, I mean, this is a statement of intent. The other thing we're seeing now from Fab is the Julian Alvarez deal is done. We've been arguing about this with Anders off camera. What are the odds now, just to update it, that LAFC gets this done?
Yeah, so for those who haven't been following, Atletico Madrid have been after Julian Alvarez of Manchester City, the Argentinian World Cup and Copa America winner, who was Erling Haaland's backup. So he wanted out of Manchester City. I can't blame him at all. They got that across the line. They also appear to be set to sell João Félix to Chelsea. That still leaves them with seven forwards. Now, granted, Diego Simeone has always preferred to play with two forwards. So you want to have depth there, but I don't think you want to have seven guys. And for Antoine Griezmann, he's the one who makes the most sense as a departure at this point.
And he's just watching Instagram, Doyle, seeing his boys just have a good old time with Will Ferrell and making runs in the League's Cup. And Olivier's hitting him up saying, you sure you don't want to get here now? It's pretty tight. LA's nice.
And I got to tell you, this is going to sound ridiculous, but it's not. Antoine Griezmann is like the world's biggest NBA fan. And we just saw what LeBron James did at the Olympics. And this coming season is going to be a circus around the Lakers every single game because of Bronny. And because at some point, one of these years has to be LeBron's last truly great year. And I suspect that Antoine Griezmann wants to be in LA for that. So I think the chances of the Griezmann deal getting done in the next 72 hours just increased exponentially.
Somebody have LeBron text this man, call this man, get in his DMs, whatever it is. Antoine Griezmann to MLS, to LAFC this summer. Make it happen. Anyway, you can listen to our Griezmann chat in just a little bit and see where our brains were before this unscheduled interruption. Back to extra time. All right, FC Cincinnati, Pat Noonan. This has been sort of on our lips all summer long. Aaron Bupenza's time with Cincinnati is over. Tom Bogert reported that. Then the official stuff came out. This is not a buyout. This is basically a breach of contract of some sort. Basically, MLS saying, hey, this contract is no longer valid based on, I don't even know, so I'm not going to even speculate. Fill in the blank. Point is, there's an open DP spot for Cincy. You think they fill it? Is there enough time?
I go back to that Kurt Schmid quote about striking when the iron's hot, and you know, going after something when the window's open. And Cincy's window for title contention is open right now. Leagues Cup, Supporters Shield, MLS Cup, all on the table. Lucho's 30, so he should have, you know, hopefully two or three top years left. But this is a chance to win something with him and in part for him. You look at the way those fans reacted when he checked into the game the other night. It was bonkers. So I think they probably feel like they owe it to themselves to go after this in a big way. I haven't heard a single thing about who they could be going after, not since the Weston McKennie stuff from a couple of months ago, and that has reportedly gone quiet, though I don't think Weston has signed with a new club yet, and he's not in the plans at Juventus, so maybe something could happen there. But I don't think that Cincy are going to sit on their hands. I expect by the time we're doing the show again on Thursday, we're going to have a big Cincinnati move to talk about.
And look, it's not like they were spending the entirety of the window or the many months before the window looking around saying, well, we better not accumulate any potential targets just in case we want to move on from Aaron Bupenza. Like, I don't think this was in any way something that took the club by surprise. So we'll see if they had the irons in the fire and have the motivation or think it's the right move to do right now. But I do think there are some decisions coming at the end of the year too with, some first of all, Luca Arciano and how you keep him. Noonan says they want to keep him long term. Kevin Kelce, what the end game is on that. And if you don't sign a DP now, one perhaps in the winter. But yeah, we'll see. Cincinnati under a little bit of deadline pressure. The Rebs seem to have got their deals done, unless something else is coming here. Doyle, we got Luca Langone from Boca. You have the center back swap of Kessler and Parker. You've got DeJuan Jones out and Will Sands in. Now, official this morning, Nigeria international midfielder Alassane Youssou from Royal Antwerp. Fee is somewhere north of $2 million, according to Tom Bogert. It's a 24-year-old with 7 caps for Nigeria, recently broke through, recently won a title with Antwerp. Mark Van Bommel has been his manager. That's a decent central midfielder to learn from. And Caleb Porter is absolutely raving about this guy. And there's also rumors, by the way, that Noel Buck could be headed to West Brom. What do you make of this particular window for the New England Revolution?
I mean, they clearly wanted to remake a lot about their back line in central midfield, which is understandable given how much they've struggled this year. Trading DeJuan Jones is a big vote of confidence in 16-year-old Peyton Miller, who's gotten, I think, 3 or 4 starts in a row now at left back. He's a high upside young academy kid, has looked really good. Youssouf, I think he comes in probably and plays over either Matt Polster or Marc-Anthony Kay, brings some range and some ball-winning ability, which I think that they've needed. I'm not sure they're necessarily a better team now than they were at the start of the window, but they have a path. I think it's starting to feel like they have a vision for how they want to remake the roster, and they've realized that keeping together, the team that at this point last year was on a 65-point pace, keeping together that team and trying to rediscover that magic just was not going to work. And so they've gone in a different direction, and it's understandable.
All right, let's hit a mishmash of other stuff and then get to the League's Cup. Nice have entered the race, according to Fabrizio Romano, for Moise Bombito from the Rapids. You've noticed that Bombito hasn't played of late. This would be a big move. I think it was Lyon and the Eagle Group. Yes. Botafogo and Lyon that were in for him before. So somebody has pipped the Eagle Group. And Fab is also saying that RB Salzburg could also be in for him.
I mean, the Salzburg thing is interesting because obviously Chris Armas has Red Bull roots and probably still has connections with the RB Global operation. And Bombito is he's more than just a pressing center back, but his physical gifts in terms of recovery speed, first and foremost, allows you to do stuff with your pressing shape and triggers that a lot of center backs don't. So you could see very clearly why Salzburg would be interested. And as for Nice, I mean, I don't even know who their manager is right now, but if Lyon are interested, every other Ligue 1 team other than maybe PSG and Marseille will then start knocking on the doors as well. It's a sort of a herd mentality in that league. And at that point, it's up to the front office to gin up a bidding war, which I assume that they're doing as we speak. I just hope for his sake and for the sake of Canadian men's national team that they end up, he ends up in the right spot, that he ends up in a place where he plays immediately, because he's not 19. He's not
24. He's 24. The runway is not quite as long. Yep. Even just for his development, because I think that's still the stage that he's in based on his professional trajectory. Speaking of professional trajectories and needing some minutes, Tom Bogert reporting that Montreal acquired Canada youth international Jaquiel Marshall-Ruddy from Toronto. Initially, 850K GAM, but up to 1.3. I think that's going to be the biggest number ever, both upfront and perhaps overall for a homegrown. There's a sell-on clause that Toronto will hold on to. Marshall-Ruddy is still just 20, Doyle. He's made 83 appearances for Toronto FC. Then another deal for Montreal. They picked up Caden Clark from Minnesota United for some super drift throw-ins and 50K in game, et cetera. But the big one is Jaquiel Marshall-Ruddy. This is kind of crazy because there was a long period of time where it was just assumed that Jaquiel was going to be sold for like 8 figs.
Yeah.
And it just never happened.
Yeah, they never were able to develop him. Multiple coaches, multiple game models. I don't think that the instability at the top in Toronto did him or anyone else any good. And I hope that Montreal, I hope that Laurent Courtois is able to get the best out of him. It'll be fun to see if, like, he and Nathan Saliba and, you know, they have a couple other promising young Canadian kids, if Montreal could get that that assembly line of talent starting to run again.
Feels like a wing back might be in this 5-3-2 or whatever it is that Montreal like to play.
I think so.
You know, even more than that, because we're just sort of like guessing at what could be for him down the line. You don't have to guess at the fact that it feels to me like Toronto have done a pretty poor job bringing their young players through for a little while now.
I don't think you could argue with that at all.
Even back, like Marc-Anthony Kay all the way back there to like Io and the way that sort of stalled. And I mean, Jacob Schaffelberg, I'm not saying he's a world even beater, but
DeAndre Kerr should have been getting more minutes this year from the jump. You know, he was one of the few silver linings last year. And this year, I know he started off the season hurt, but like even when he was back healthy, he has only been like, he's rarely been getting starters minutes. And that doesn't make any sense to me, given that he's been, I think, the best center forward on this team for the past 12 months.
All right, let's keep it going. Minnesota United, according to Andrew Greeter, is in advanced talks on the transfer of Argentina attacking midfield Joaquin Pereira, who's at Atletico Tucumán right now. So if they get him, that would be on a DP deal, I assume, based on his valuation, which I just take it with a grain of salt. Transfer Market has him at $4.5 million. That would be, if they get it done, Pereira, striker Kelvin Yeboah, who's a DP, Jefferson Diaz, a center back from Colombia, and a new right back in the window. Also, Minnesota are dealing right now with Taniolo Shea out 3 to 5 weeks with a hamstring injury. He got hurt against Necaxa. Interesting end of the season for Minnesota. We'll see what this guy is or if the deal gets done. This deal did get done. Philadelphia Union signed Haiti international midfielder Daniel Jean. Ah, oh, man, I suck at
Danley Jean-Jacques.
Jean-Jacques, thank you. I thought about saying that, but then I pulled out before I could ever get there. Mets just got relegated from Ligue 1, but Jean-Jacques played a ton for them in midfield, and Curtin says he can play the six, he can play the shuttler position, so it seems like a really smart signing for them. And then
I wonder if that portends any move for, like, you know, Jose Martinez has been there a long time. And
you think Jose Martinez? I would say Jack McGlynn more than Jose Martinez.
Leon Flock as well. But I do wonder if there's going to be a reshuffling at the end of this year, even amongst the veterans in Philadelphia.
LA Galaxy goalkeeper situation. Novak Micevic, according to Bogert. He started the first two Galaxy League Cup games, and then in the loss to Seattle, John McCarthy got the start. Micevic, apparently, upon hearing those news, requested a transfer from the club, and it turned into this whole thing. The Galaxy are saying, no, hold on. You're in our long-term plans for sure, but there's a bit of drama for you. The Galaxy are now out, so those games for Micevic are gone. It seems crazy to me if they told him he was going to be the League's Cup guy, and maybe they didn't. Maybe they said, you know, we'll see what happens. McCarthy's going to need games down the line. But if they told him you're the guy for League's Cup and then pulled that away, I can understand why Micevic was pretty hacked off, though requesting a transfer might be a bit much. Speaking of the Galaxy, though, Doyle, as we go to the biggest stories to watch, Marco Reus, according to Fab Romano, is done. Do you think that kills Tom, or do you think he's surviving this potential pipping? He was at his bachelor party weekend. Tough time to time out your bachelor party right before the end of the transfer window, Tom. I don't know who we got to talk to about that, whether it's you or your boys, but you could have just waited till the window closed, my guy.
Also, shouts to the folks at RSL show, because they're the ones who broke the Andres Gomez move. They pipped Tom and Fab.
Ouch.
I think Tom had maybe one too many wiffle ball bats filled with beer this weekend.
Yeah, maybe so. So that's big news for the Galaxy, as is Bournemouth, apparently in advanced talks per Fab of signing Julian Araujo from Barcelona on a permanent transfer. Deal would be around 10 million euros, which would mean a couple million dollars.
I think that's officially done now, right?
Done? Okay.
I think so.
So there's some money back into the pot for the LA Galaxy. Well done to them. And we're still monitoring Griezmann. You think it gets? It doesn't seem like it's going to get done this window, yeah?
It doesn't, but man, I really hope it does, because it just anything that makes the league more fun, and having a player of Antoine Griezmann's stature, and continued excellence in the league makes it more fun, for one, and for two, hatred makes the league more fun. And man, people would really, really hate LAFC if they were. And look, I understand. You look at this roster and they have so many, it seems like they have so many big names, and they've spent so much money, but they're a team that uses their U22 spots really, really well. And those slots only hit the cap at $150,000 to $200,000. So if you have a GM who understands that and knows how to build a roster, you could have those big name young South American players, and you could go out and get three DPs like Denny Bouanga, Olivier Giroud, and potentially Antoine Griezmann. And I just love seeing how angry fans of other teams are getting about this.
He's talking to you, Anders.
I'm talking directly at Anders.
Yes. Speaking of anger, I have a lot of Atlanta fans in my mentions right now, Doyle, because they don't have their DP number 9 in the bag. Moranchuk is done. But Steven Bergwijn, maybe? There's some reporting out there from some of the folks that are doing the Calvin Stengs reporting, saying that Bergwijn is going to be perhaps headed to Atlanta. A bid was rejected by Ajax for the Netherlands international. Would this be a good signing? Would this meet your? Would it meet the threshold between to oh?
This would be above that. Bergwijn is 26 years old. He's not a fringe Dutch international. He's a guy who played, I think, every game for the Dutch national team at the World Cup 2 years ago. And I think he played 3 or 4 games for them as they made a run to the semis in the Euros. He was Ajax's, I think, second top scorer. Granted, not a good Ajax team, but second top scorer and their captain this past year. He didn't make it for Tottenham. Right, he just for whatever reason he was not cut out to play in the Premier League, but this is in terms of his resume, or since he's European, we'll call it his CV. It's more impressive than Stengs, and you heard how we raved about the Calvin Stengs signing. Granted, he'll probably cost 3 times as much, but after the summer that Atlanta just had in selling guys like Almada, Yakumakis, and Caleb Wiley, they have money to burn. And I think between Moranchuk and Saba and Bergwijn, if you have 3 guys like that, you don't need to go out and get a DP number 9. You can get just a reliable professional veteran number 9 and maybe use a U22 slot on a backup, and you will find goals with a creative trio like that.
Well, tick, tick, tick. Atlanta United, time is ticking. August 14th is the deadline, unless you're going to go pick up somebody who's a free agent. Red Bulls are on the clock too. This deal for Jean-Philippe Gabamin, who had those connections back in the day, I believe Mainz and Sandro Schwartz, that's off, apparently after the medical. So adios to that one. That had Red Bulls fans down a little bit bad, not going to lie. But now Tom Bogert is reporting this morning that the Red Bulls are finalizing a deal to sign Uruguay international central midfielder Felipe Carballo from Gremio. So that would be a designated player. He's 27, has 7 caps with Uruguay. Seems like he sort of fell out at Gremio after a really nice career at Nacional. And then maybe a U22 forward, Doyle. Is that enough? I'm thinking back to my more ambition whiteboard that I still stand by. I'm still not quite sure we're reaching the level of ambition that I would hope for the Red Bulls.
So I like, just looking at the career that Carballo has had, I actually like that as a signing better than Babin. So that is a good first step. It's a little... At the same time, it's a little disappointing because the Red Bulls have four young central midfielders that I really enjoy, and Edelman, Doncor, Stroud, and I think Wiki Carmona has been better as a central midfielder than an attacker. So one of those guys is going to get pushed out of the rotation, which is a little bit of a bummer. If they end up getting a U22 number nine, and the guy that I think is the target is Roko Simic from RB Salzburg, who's a Croatian youth international, was pretty prolific for them, for the Croatian U21 team, but hasn't been super prolific for Salzburg. But if they get him, then yeah, that's a really good window. They come out of this window better than they entered it. And while I don't think they would necessarily be MLS Cup contenders this year, their core is all at a place where you expect them to improve. With the exception of Emil Forsberg.
Is it? I was going to say, is it? Because isn't like the high-end core still Van Zier, Morgan, and Forsberg?
I think Van Zier is gone at the end of this year.
I do too, but if we're talking about the rest of the year and trying to do something of any note.
Well, I was saying, like, this is in the context of 2025. Like, I would look at this team as one that I would have higher hopes for in 2025.
You want them to go all in
to try to win.
Not even all in, man. I just wanted them to have a credible MLS Cup case to make. You know, I think there's a case to be made right now. Is it credible in the sense that you believe they can actually do it? No, I don't think so. Maybe if Forsberg was healthy and balling out every week and it was like, hey, chisel it in stone, you're going to have a motivated, productive Emil Forsberg on the field for close to 90 minutes every game, I could talk myself into it. Without that, I can't. I guess that can change. Look, his health can change. His availability can change. When he has played, when he's been healthy, he's been very good. I don't look at the roster and think, you know, over the course of an MLS Cup playoffs against teams in the Eastern Conference like Cincinnati or Miami or Columbus, etc., that they're going to be in a position to, I mean, even Charlotte with the moves that they're making, that they're going to be in that position. But hey, maybe I'm wrong. It's been a good season so far. Good. I guess I just always want great from the Red Bulls, and I don't know. Maybe that's New York bias. All right, let's one more thing here. I just want to let you know, just in case you didn't know, you probably do. Lionel Messi is working in the gym, Doyle. He's working in the gym. I think he's lost the boot as well, and his ankle is improving every day. Just throwing it out there. I don't think we'll see him in Leagues Cup, but maybe when Miami re-enter play. All right, here we go. Leagues Cup round of 16. This is the exercise that we went through. We ranked all 16 teams from 16-1 in order of likelihood of winning the tournament, in our opinion. No other math or science thrown into the cauldron on this one, Doyle. So get us started. Who is the least likely team to win Leagues Cup based on our round of 16 group?
It's Mazatlan. They're not going to win four or five straight road games, and which is what they would need to do. They got by DC United because of that stupid red card that I talked about from Jared Stroud. They're playing Cruz Azul. If they get past Cruz Azul, they most likely have to play Cincinnati. If they get past Cincinnati, they most likely have to play Columbus, Miami, or Tigres in the semifinal. There's just no way. Well done to get as far as they have, but like I think it ends tomorrow night.
I think that's a good call, and that's no disrespect to Mazatlan. I think getting this far has been a really good run for them as well. They did lose to Cruz Azul earlier in the season. Cruz Azul had a red card in that match after 75 minutes, but scored in the 90+4. So there is a little bit of recency in this matchup between the two. I think the big question mark is like, where do the goals come from for Mazatlan? It feels like Amaria and Coleman, who we know well from MLS days, have sort of been pushed out of the lineup right now. So we'll see. Ramiro Arciga has been the guy for them, but that's just two goals in one game and his first goals as a professional at this level. So maybe Brian Rubio can provide him. Maybe, you know, Del Prete can be a provider. We will see. But Mazatlan's
biggest win might be getting an MLS team to spend $6 million on Arciga based upon what he did against Nashville.
Hey, they just sold Andres Montaño, so they're open to it. At number 15, we have the San Jose Earthquakes. And as beautiful as that win against Necaxa was, as inspiring as the performance was against Chivas, LAFC on the road, and then one of Seattle Pumas, and then probably America, maybe, I don't know, either way.
Maybe Toluca.
Yeah, going on the road. for a lot of these matchups, just depending on who it is out of the MLS side. That seems extremely unlikely, no matter how good the vibes are right now.
14, we put New York City. NYCFC, they host Tigres. Then they'll go on the road to Columbus. Though they would host Miami if
they
Miami
would,
beat, yeah. So it's look,
but you got to beat Tigres before you get to that point. So let's not be too far ahead of ourselves.
You got to beat Tigres. Like if you look at this bracket, this is the bracket of death. Like before the tournament started, I made up a tiers piece, like the seven favorites. Three of them are Tigres, Miami, Columbus. So NYCFC have a lot of talent. They have a couple different ways to beat you now, because with Maxi back, you could push Santi out to the wing and become more of a patient possession team, as opposed to like being, I don't want to say purely, but primarily transition with Santi as the number 10. So they're fun and they could be a real problem by the time the playoffs come around, but they're prohibitive underdogs against all three of those teams. And then they would probably have to go to Cincinnati. Like it seems too much.
Let alone the final. After that, I think the same thing goes for Colorado, who's our number 13 team here. And look, you're going to host Toluca. Toluca hasn't been at, let's say, their 2023 Leagues Cup level, I don't think, in this tournament, but have big-time pieces that are gelling and have Jesus Angulo and Paulinho and others, really good attacking pieces. Plus, Volpi as a goalkeeper always just has something. Mm-hmm. So first, you're going to get to Toluca. So if you did that, okay, props to you. Then it's probably America. Then it's probably LAFC or Seattle, and it's probably the road the rest of the way. And even if you get St. Louis, if you beat Toluca, you would have to go to St. Louis. So just feels like things are stacked up against them a little bit right now in that sense. And then we have St. Louis Doyle at 12, and that's just because when you're playing Club America, it doesn't matter where you're doing it. The odds are against you. And oh, by the way, St. Louis lost 4-0 last year in this competition to the Aguilas.
Yeah, St. Louis playing much better ball. Like their signings this window, not just Toichert and Hartle, who have been as advertised, but Simon Becher doing this. You know, he looks like his old teammate Brian White in terms of how he plays that role. Just occupying, like being fundamentally sound, occupying center backs, taking what is given to him, letting other guys be the stars. So they're a much better team, and under John Hackworth, I think they're playing with the ball a little bit more, which I like to see. It's been fun, but they're playing Club America, who are the best and most successful team in North America for a reason. And then if they get past them, then they'll be playing most likely, I think, a Toluca team that spent $25 million this window and have arguably the best center forward in the tournament in Paulinho. It's going to be a lot for St. Louis.
I will say, why did nobody trade for Simon Becher when it was clear that he was moving on from Vancouver? Like, how did a Danish, small Danish team get in first?
It's a really good question.
I don't get it, especially based on the team he was coming from and the productivity and all the, you know, all the case studies we sort of have of super draft slash young domestic forwards that have, you know, if not been world beaters, been extremely credible adds to their respective sides. Like, I don't get how he got away, so to speak.
Me neither. I'm really happy to see that he landed in St. Louis, though, because I think he's a starter there for a long time. I think he fits what they seem to want to do now. They've changed their game model in a really positive and fun to watch way. And it could end up being another Brian White type of story, a sort of a happy story for a domestic product. And we always like to see that happen.
Maybe it's a case of needing a more robust internal market where if you can go outside of MLS, you can get cold hard cash, and inside MLS, it's allocation money. And maybe the cash was more worthwhile in that moment to the Whitecaps. I don't know. How about Pumas at 11? No disrespect to the boys of Gustavo Lema, but yeah, you got to go to Seattle, a house of horrors for you. It doesn't seem like the number nine spot's really shaken out for them. And no matter what, they're on the road the rest of the way. And that's just a huge disadvantage.
Yeah, they'll be at Seattle, and they get past Seattle, they're either at LAFC or a red hot San Jose team. Sorry, Maria. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, probably not. Number 10, Philly. They are back to playing Union Soccer. It is much better, but going on the road to Cincinnati is very difficult. And then you would think it's Cruz Azul up next. And I know they played Cruz Azul toe-to-toe, but at some point that talent gap is going to jump up and bite somebody. And then the winner of the group of death. So it just feels like Philadelphia in the middle of the pack, where it's believable that they could make a run, but unlikely.
Yep. After them, we have the Sounders, who are getting really good center forward play from Jordan Morris, better than you gave him credit for.
Let me raise my hand on this one. Like, I know that he's been having, one, good performances, but also being productive in terms of goals. Maybe I just don't. There's like a bias here where I just can't quite believe that Jordan Morris at the nine is going to be consistently excellent, because I don't know that we've ever seen him be consistently excellent. We have definitely seen him be excellent in spurts. I was a doubter. I was a hater.
Yeah.
And I'm regretting those words now.
He's been so good, and it's not just stretching the field. He's always had, you know, the pace and power, but he's been so much more clever in his movement in the final third when the Sounders are in pure possession, which is not something that I think anybody ever associated with Jordan Morris in the few times that we got to see him play. I mean, part of the reason he played on the wing for most of his career is because he wasn't good at that type of movement in the final third. He didn't do the Bradley Wright Phillips things in terms of finding the half spaces and sliding over to the sort of the B gap and then back into the A gap and splitting the set. Like, he's doing all that stuff now, and he's linking play. And of course, he's always been a committed defensive presence no matter where he's played. He's been really good. The Sounders have, I think, a really functional central midfield trio that can occasionally be spectacular when Albert Rusnak is really cooking. In order for them to be better than a really good team, they need more dynamism from that left wing spot. And unfortunately, Pedro de la Vega is hurt again. Now, this opens the door for Paul Rothrock, who's been really, really good. And I've enjoyed this story, but I find it hard to believe that Paul Rothrock is going to be the type of ceiling raiser that this Sounders team needs.
You take it all back. By the way, if Pumas hear that Undertaker music at some point, the ringing of the bell, that's going to be Raul Ruiz Diaz coming off the bench. You'll remember Ruiz Diaz had a couple goals against Pumas in that CONCACAF Champions League final. It's going to be a really fun matchup here on Monday night. It stands alone on MLS Season Pass, so if you jump on the show as soon as it comes out, you have plenty of time to watch it. We will have a 30-minute pregame show, MLS Countdown, at 10 p.m. 10:30 is when the game starts on MLS Season Pass. Okay, Toluca is at 8. I think we've sort of talked through that. I mean, they're right there in the middle. It's difficult because they have to go on the road, but have a ton of talent, etc. Cruz Azul is number 7. We're really not ranking the Cimentero is very high. La Máquina, though, Doyle, hasn't been very machine-like in this tournament. It's all penalties for all three games and advancement in two, and just missing a final piece of the puzzle. Quality chances, just possession, yes. Shots, yes. True quality goal-scoring chances, not as prevalent.
They play, in my view, they play kind of like 2-8s. Two sixes and three eights. And one of the eights is actually Ignacio Rivero, who they have playing as a second forward, who's supposed to be, you know, Georgi Giakoumakis' partner, but it hasn't been working out that way, at least in League's Cup play so far. Giakoumakis has been kind of stranded, and it's put stress, I think, on the wingbacks to do a little bit more chance creation.
And it's really just been Rotondi in that sense. It hasn't been as much Jorge Sanchez.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a team with a lot of talent. Pieces don't necessarily fit together. It's crazy to say this because I've never rated him, but I think Oriol Antuna needs to start because he's actually a natural attacker. And maybe if you put him next to Giakoumakis, he could add at least a second heat and give them a little bit more punch going forward.
I don't think that's crazy. I mean, he was tied for the golden boot in the last tournament.
So there you go.
Yeah. Anyway, all right. Miami's at 6. Did we underrate them? And they're gonna have to go on the road just because of their seeding, unless they get Liga MX teams.
Yeah, I think this is a little bit underrated given that they're the support, they're, you know, leading the supporter shield race by a good amount at this point, given that they've shown the ability to beat teams in different ways. You know, they've gone on the road and just beaten teams on set pieces. And that is the mark of a really high level team. The thing that I think argues for knocking them down to this level is that David Martinez is suspended for this game. And I thought he was a difference maker at center back in terms of his ability to help them control the game with the ball. And being without that as you go on the road to face a Columbus team that, granted, has not been as successful against Miami recently as they have been against everybody else.
Yeah, but outplayed Miami even when they lost.
I agree. I agree completely. It's look, they'll have to go through Columbus, and then they'll most likely be hosting Tigres, who have already beaten them. This is tough.
We have Tigres up next at 5, which is, I mean, look, again, you're at the cream of the crop here. So I think I'd probably put Tigres before Cincinnati at this point, because I think there's some unknowns with Cincinnati and the defense hasn't been as strong as you would want it to be. But Tigres is 5 for us. They're going to go on the road. They have all the pieces. It wouldn't surprise me at all for them to ramp it up here the rest of the tournament. I've felt personally, Doyle, that they've been sort of idling in second gear, just saying, oh, yeah, well, we'll just keep games under control, and we've got better attacking talent than you do, and, well, to be fair, attacking talent throughout the field, and we'll just come up with the big moment we need to. But they're in a really tough bracket, so they go 5. Cincinnati go 4. Did the Awaziem mistake concern you at all? Did the performance against Santos concern you? Because Santos are bad. They're a poor team, and a 1-1 draw at home and sneaking through in PKs isn't exactly a huge vote of confidence.
I mean, the mistakes happen when you play out of the back. They pounced back and they dominated the rest of that game. They just were not able to find the winner. And then they did get a little bit fortunate with that PK being skied and Roman Celentano celebrating like he saved it. But they got through, survive in advance.
That was an act of intimidation, Doyle. Come on. Yeah.
And, you know, Lucho Acosta back for, I think, the final 35 minutes of that one. Maybe more help on the way. Clarity, at least, with the status of Aaron Bupenza, which probably helps the vibes. DeAndre Yedlin back. I think this is a really good team. It shouldn't shock anybody if they win this thing.
And then 2 or 3, Columbus or LAFC. Which side are you going down on?
I picked Columbus to win this thing at the start, and I'm still riding that.
Okay, so you're pushing them to 1. That means Club America or LAFC.
Yeah. Yep. LAFC, we've talked about this team. If they play with that front three, even if they don't get the Griezmann signing over the line, front three of Denny Bouanga, Olivier Giroud, and Kiki Oliveira,
Or Bogus.
Mateus Bogus, or even their David Martinez, the 18-year-old Venezuelan who's been good in such limited minutes.
I'm less convinced that David Martinez is ready for that stage, but I hear you, and I beg Steve Cherundolo to put Giroud in for some significant minutes in this one. I'm sure not as a starter, but let's see him off the bench. Like, let's get that integration process started.
The thing I want to see is a reversion to that 4-3-3, though. What we've seen so far is kind of a 5-4-1 from LAFC in this tournament. They're playing against the ball. I honestly thought Austin were better than they were. It's just that with Denny Bouanga, you have the ability to turn one misplayed pass, misplayed clearance into a 1-0 lead. And that just changes the game.
You want Steve to change the calibration between risk and reward, basically.
Yeah, because I think when LAFC have been at their best throughout the season, they were playing more on the front foot. They were using the ball a little bit more, a lot more than they have throughout Leagues Cup. And the version of the LAFC we've gotten in the Leagues Cup so far is what we saw in last year's playoffs when it was too far. The calibration was too far towards being risk averse.
That leaves Club America, who I had number 1.
Tell us why.
I mean, I just think, first of all, I think the recent pedigree, I think Arde Jardine is an amazing manager, as he's proved already, with the ability to come up with solutions. The attacking talent is there, even though they've lost Julian Quiñones. They just went out and got more. The one thing I will always say about Aguilas as well, folks in Mexico might say this less diplomatically, but it just feels like things always go their way. It just feels like whether it's a play that they make or a call that happens in a critical moment, it just feels like America somehow, some way, sneak that little pinky toe through when odds are against them. And in this case, odds are not against them. So we'll
would
see.
Would you take Club America's attacking talent over Columbus's? I think if you look at these, if you line up these rosters.
Cucho versus Henry Martin. Who are you taking?
Cucho.
I'll take Cucho, yeah.
And then it's what? Diego Rossi versus Di Lorson, the Dutch guy that they got.
Yeah, Di Lorson is looking pretty good. I think I probably take Diego Rossi, but this is probably all biased too. You know what I mean? It's like you're asking someone who watches every Crew game with wonder and respect versus somebody who just drops in and out on America and doesn't have the full feel. So, yeah, Eric Sanchez versus who? Who would be the equivalent?
I mean, we're getting into like how the two formations are different, right? Because it's a 4-2-3-1 for Club America, and Sanchez sometimes plays as a number 10, sometimes plays as an 8, sometimes plays as a winger. But I think if Sanchez was on Columbus, he would be starting next to Darlington Nagbe. I think he would be starting deeper than he starts for Club America.
Fair. Look, if Zendejas wasn't hurt, maybe he would be in one of those 2-10 spots for Columbus. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think it's pretty even up and down the roster. I would argue that America's back six is a little bit more accomplished, let's say, but on paper, that's all it is. Columbus made on paper look pretty worthless in the CONCACAF Champions Cup this year against Tigres and Monterrey, and almost got the job done at the death against Pachuca as well, despite well-documented gastrointestinal issues. Anyway, that's it for us. Enjoy the rounds of 16 of Leagues Cup. We'll be back on the back end of that one to get you ready for the quarterfinals and update you on any transfer dealings that happen over the course of the next few days. The window, of course, closes on the 14th. Enjoy Monday and Tuesday games on MLS Season Pass. Leagues Cup rolling on. We'll see you then. Adios.